Side 8. Addressing himself to the task of restoring his ruffled nerves, the Honourable Galahad had swallowed perhaps a third of the contents of the long tumbler when he observed the butler returning. "What on earth have you got there, Beach?" he asked, for the other seemed heavily laden for a man who had been sent to fetch a pair of tortoiseshell-rimmed spectacles. "That's not my manuscript." "Yes, Mr. Galahad." "Take it back," said the author, with pardonable peevishness. "I don't want it. Good Lord, I came out here to forget it." He broke off, mystified. A strange, pop-eyed expression had manifested itself on the butler's face, and his swelling waistcoat was beginning to quiver faintly. The Honourable Galahad watched these phenomena with interest and curiosity. "What are you waggling your tummy at me for, Beach?"
"I am uneasy, Mr. Galahad.
You shouldn't wear flannel vests, then, in weather like this."
"Mentally uneasy, sir."
"What about?"
"The safety of this book of yours, Mr. Galahad." The butler lowered his voice. "May I inform you, sir, of what occurred a few moments ago, when I proceeded to the small library to find your glasses?"
"What?"
"Just as I was about to enter, I heard movements within."
"You did?"
The Honourable Galahad clicked his tongue.
"I wish to goodness people would keep out of that room. They know I use it as my private study."
"Precisely, Mr. Galahad. Nobody has any business there while you are in residence at the castle. That is an understood thing. And it was for that reason that I immediately found myself entertaining suspicions."
"Eh? Suspicions? How do you mean?"
"That some person was attempting to purloin the material which you have written, sir."
"What?"
"Yes, Mr. Galahad. And I was right. I paused for an instant," said the butler impressively, "and then flung the door open sharply and without warning. Sir, there was Mr. Pilbeam standing with his hand in the open drawer."
"Pilbeam?"
"Yes, Mr. Galahad."
"Good gad."
"Yes, Mr. Galahad."
"What did you say?"
"Nothing, Mr. Galahad. I looked."
"What did he say?"
"Nothing, Mr. Galahad. He smiled."
"Smiled?"
"In a weak, guilty manner."
"And then?"
"Still without speaking, I proceeded to the desk, secured the written material, and started to leave the room. At the door I paused and gave him a cold glance. I then withdrew."
"Splendid, Beach."
"Thank you, Mr. Galahad."
"You're sure he was trying to steal the thing?"
"The papers were actually in his grasp, sir."
"He couldn't have just been looking for notepaper or something?"
"A man of Beach's build could not look like Sherlock Holmes listening to fatuous theories from Dr. Watson, nor could a man of his position, conversing with a social superior, answer as Holmes would have done. The word tush may have trembled on his lips, but it got no farther." "No, sir," he said briefly.
"But his motive? What possible motive could this extraordinary little perisher have for wanting to steal my book?"
A certain embarrassment seemed to grip Beach. He hesitated. "Might I take a liberty, Mr. Galahad?"
"Don't talk rot, Beach. Liberty? I never heard such nonsense. Why, we've known each other since we were kids of 40.
"Thank you, Mr. Galahad. Then, if I may speak freely, I should like to recapitulate briefly the peculiar circumstances connected with this book. In the first place, may I say that I am aware of its extreme importance as a factor in the affairs of Mr. Ronald and Miss Brown." The Honourable Galahad gave a little jump. He had always known the butler as a man who kept his eyes open and his ears pricked up, and informed himself sooner or later of most things that happened at the castle, but he had not realized that his secret service system was quite so efficient as this. "In order to overcome the opposition of her ladyship to the union of Mr. Ronald and Miss Brown, you expressed your willingness to refrain from giving this volume of reminiscences into the printer's hands, her ladyship being hostile to its publication, owing to the fact that, in her opinion, its contents might give offence to many of her friends, notably Sir Gregory Parslow. Am I not correct, Mr. Galahad?"
"Quite right."
"Your motive in making this concession being that you were apprehensive lest, without this check upon her actions, her ladyship might possibly persuade his lordship to refuse to countenance the match."
"Possibly is good. You needn't be coy, Beach. This meeting is tiled. No reporters present. We can take our hair down and tell each other our right names. What you actually mean is that my brother Clarence is as weak as water, and that if it wasn't for this book of mine, there would be nothing to stop my sister Constance nagging him into a state where he would agree to forbid a dozen weddings just for the sake of peace and quiet.
Exactly, Mr. Galahad. I would not have ventured to put the matter into precisely those words myself. But since you have done so, I feel free to point out that, the circumstances being as you have outlined, it would be very agreeable to her ladyship were this manuscript to be stolen and destroyed. The Honorable Galahad sat up, electrified.
Beach, you've hit it. That fella Pilbeam was working for Connie.
The evidence would certainly appear to point in that direction, Mr. Galahad.
Probably Parslow sitting in with them.
I feel convinced of it, Mr. Galahad. I may mention that on the night of our last dinner party, her ladyship instructed me with considerable agitation to summon Sir Gregory to the castle by telephone for an urgent conference. Her ladyship and Sir Gregory were closeted in the library for some little time, and then Sir Gregory emerged, obviously laboring under considerable excitement, and a few moments later I observed him talking to Mr. Pilbeam very earnestly in a secluded corner of the hall.
Giving him his riding orders.
Precisely, Mr. Galahad, plotting. The significance of the incident eluded me at the time, but I am now convinced that that was what was transpiring. The Honorable Galahad rose.
Beach, he observed with emotion, I've said it before, and I say it again. You're worth your weight in gold. You've saved the situation. You have preserved the happiness of two young lives, Beach.
It's very kind of you to say so, sir.
I do say so. It's no use our kidding ourselves. With that manuscript out of the way, those two wouldn't have a dog's chance of getting married. I know Clarence. Capital fella. Nobody I'm fonder of in the world, but constitutionally incapable of standing up against arguing women. We must take steps immediately to ensure the safety of this manuscript, Beach.
I was about to suggest, Mr. Galahad, that it might be advisable if, in future, you were to lock the drawer in which you keep it. The Honorable Galahad shook his head.
That's no good. You don't suppose a determined woman like my sister Constance, aided and abetted by this ghastly little weasel of a detective, is going to be stopped by a locked drawer? No. We must think of something better than that. I've got it. You must take the thing, Beach, and keep it in some safe place. In your pantry, for instance.
But Mr. Galahad...
Now what?
Suppose her ladyship were to learn that the papers were in my possession and were to request me to hand them to her. It would precipitate a situation of considerable delicacy were I to meet such a demand with a flat refusal.
How on earth is she to know you've got it? She doesn't ever drop into your pantry for a chat, does she?
Certainly not, Mr. Galahad, said the butler, shuddering at the horrid vision the words called up.
And at night you could sleep with it under your pillow. No risk of Lady Constance coming to tuck you up in bed, what?
This time, Beach's emotion was such that he could merely shudder silently.
"It's the only plan," said the Honorable Galahad with decision. "I don't want any argument. You take this manuscript and you put it away somewhere where it'll be safe. Be a man, Beach."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad.
Do it now."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad.
And naturally not a word to a soul."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad." Beach walked slowly away across the lawn. His head was bowed, his heart heavy. It was a moment when a butler of spirit should have worn something of the gallant air of a soldier commissioned to carry dispatches through the enemy's lines. Beach did not look like that. He resembled far more nearly in his general demeanour one of those unfortunate gentlemen in railway station waiting rooms who, having injudiciously consented at 4:30 to hold a baby for a strange woman, look at the clock and see that it is now 6:15 and no relief in sight. Dusk was closing down on the forbidding day. Sue, looking out over her battlements, became conscious of an added touch of the sinister in the view beneath her. It was the hour when ghouls are abroad, and there seemed no reason why such ghouls should not decide to pay a visit to this roof on which she stood. She came to the conclusion that she had been here long enough. Eerie little noises were chuckling through the world, and somewhere in the distance an owl had begun to utter its ominous cry. She yearned for her cozy bedroom, with the lights turned on and something to read till dressing for dinner time. It was very dark on the stone stairs, and they rang unpleasantly under her feet. Nevertheless, though considering it probable that at any moment an icy hand would come out from nowhere and touch her face, she braved the descent. Her relief as her groping fingers touched the comforting solidity of the door was short-lived.
It gave way a moment later to the helpless panic of the human being trapped. The door was locked. She scurried back up the stairs onto the roof, where at least there was light to help her cope with this disaster. She remembered now. Half an hour before, a footman had come up and hauled down the flag which during the day floated over Blanding's castle. He had not seen her, and it had not occurred to her to reveal her presence. But she wished now that she had done so, for, supposing the roof empty, he had evidently completed his evening ritual by locking up. Something brushed against Sue's cheek. It was not actually a ghoul, but it was a bat, and bats are bad enough in the gloaming of a haunted day. She uttered a sharp scream, and doing so, discovered that she had unwittingly hit upon the correct procedure for girls marooned on roofs. She hurried to the battlements and began calling, "Hi!" in a small, hushed voice at first, for nothing sounds sillier than the word "hi" when thrown into the void with no definite objective. Then more loudly. Presently, warming to her work, she was producing quite a respectable volume of sound. So respectable that Ronnie Fish, smoking moodily in the garden, became aware that there were voices in the night, and after listening for a few moments, gathered that they proceeded from the castle roof. He made his way to the path that skirted the walls.
"Who's that?"
"Oh, Ronnie." For 2 days and two nights, grey doubts and black cares had been gnawing at the vitals of Ronald Fish. The poison had not ceased to work in his veins. For 2 days and two nights, he had been thinking of Sue and of Monte Bodkin. Every time he thought of Sue, it was an agony. And every time his reluctant mind turned to the contemplation of Monte Bodkin, it was anguish. But at the sound of that voice, his heart gave an involuntary leap. She might have transferred her affections to Monte Bodkin, but her voice still remained the most musical sound on earth.
"Ronnie, I can't get down."
"Are you on the roof?"
"Yes, and they've locked the door."
"I'll get the key."
And at long last, she heard the clang of the lock, and he appeared at the head of the stairs. His manner, she noted with distress, was still Eton, still Cambridge. Nobody could have been politer.
"Nuisance, getting locked in like that."
"Yes."
"Been up here long?"
"All the afternoon."
"Nice place on a fine day."
"I suppose so."
"Though hot."
"Yes."
There was a pause. The heavy air pressed down upon them. In the garden, the owl was still hooting.
"When did you get back?" asked Sue.
"About an hour ago."
"I didn't hear you."
"I didn't come to the front. I went straight round to the stables. Dropped Mother at the vicarage."
"Yes?"
"She wanted to have a talk with the vicar."
"I see."
"You've not met the vicar, have you?"
"Not yet."
"His name's Fosbury."
"Oh."
Silence fell again. Ronnie's eyes were roaming about the roof. He took a step forward, stooped, and picked up something. It was a slouch hat. He hummed a little under his breath.
"Monty been up here with you?"
"Yes."
Ronnie hummed another bar or two.
"Nice chap,"
he said.
"Let's go down, shall we?"
Chapter 8. If you turn to the right on leaving the main gates of Blanding's Castle and follow the road for a matter of 2 miles, you'll find yourself approaching the little town of Market Blandings. There it stands, dreaming the centuries away, a jewel in a green heart of Shropshire. In all England there is no sweeter spot. Artists who come to paint its old grey houses and fishermen who angle for bream in its lazy river are united on this point. The idea that the place could possibly be rendered more pleasing to the eye is one at which they would scoff, and have scoffed many a night over the pipes and tankards at the Emsworth Arms. And yet, on the afternoon following the events just recorded, this miracle occurred. The quiet charm of this ancient high street was suddenly intensified by the appearance of a godlike man in a bowler hat, who came out of an old-world tobacco shop. It was Beach the butler. With the object of disciplining his ample figure, he had walked down from the castle to buy cigarettes. He now stood on the pavement, bracing himself to the task of walking back. This athletic feat was not looking quite so good to him as it had done 3/4 of an hour ago in his pantry. That long 2-mile hike had taxed his powers of endurance. Moreover, this was no weather for marathons. If yesterday had been oppressive, today was a scorcher. Angry clouds were banking themselves in a copper-coloured sky. No breath of air stirred the trees. The pavement gave out almost visible waves of heat, and over everything there seemed to brood a sort of sulphurous gloom. If they were not in for a thunderstorm, and a snorter of a thunderstorm, before nightfall, Beach was very much mistaken. He removed his hat, produced a handkerchief, mopped his brow, replaced the hat, replaced the handkerchief, and said, "Oof." Disciplining the figure is all very well, but there are limits. An urgent desire for beer swept over Beach. He could scarcely have been more fortunately situated for the purpose of gratifying this wish. The ideal towards which the city fathers of all English county towns strive is to provide a public house for each individual inhabitant, and those of Market Blandings had not been supine in this matter. From where Beach stood, he could see no fewer than six such establishments. The fact that he chose the Emsworth Arms must not be taken to indicate that he had anything against the Wheatsheaf, the Wagoner's Rest, the Beetle and Wedge, the Stitch in Time, and the Jolly Cricketers. It was simply that it happened to be closest. Nevertheless, it was a sound choice. The advice one would give to every young man starting life is, on arriving in Market Blandings on a warm afternoon, to go to the Emsworth Arms. Good stuff may be bought there, and of all the admirable hostelries in the town, it possesses the largest and shadiest garden. Green and inviting, dotted about with rustic tables and snug summer houses, it stretches all the way down to the banks of the river, so that the happy drinker, already pleasantly in need of beer, may acquire a new and deeper thirst from watching family parties toil past in rowboats. On a really sultry day, a single father, labouring at the oars of a craft, loaded down below the plimsoll mark by a wife, a wife's sister, a cousin by marriage, four children, a dog and a picnic basket, has sometimes led to such a rush of business at the Emsworth Arms that seasoned barmaids have staggered beneath the strain. It was to one of these summer houses that Beach now took his tankard. He generally went there when circumstances caused him to visit the Emsworth Arms, for as a man with a certain position to keep up, he preferred privacy when refreshing himself. It was not as if he had been some irresponsible young second footman who could just go and squash in with the boys in the back room. This particular summer house was at the far end of the garden, hidden from the eye of the profane by a belt of bushes. Thither, accordingly, Beach made his way. There was nobody in the summer house, but he did not enter it, having a horror of earwigs and suspecting their presence in the thatch of the roof. Instead, he dragged a wicker chair to the table which stood at the back of it, and sinking into this, puffed and sipped and thought. And the more he thought, the less did he like what he thought about. As a rule, when members of the family showed their confidence in him by canvassing his assistance in any little matter, Beach was both proud and pleased. His motto was service. But he could not conceal it from himself that the family had a tendency at times to go a little too far. The historic case of this, of course, had been when Mr. Ronald, having stolen the Empress and hidden her in a disused keeper's cottage in the West Wood, had prevailed upon him to assist in feeding her. His present commission was not as fearsome an ordeal as that, but nevertheless he could not but feel that the Honourable Galahad, in appointing him the custodian of so vitally important an object as the manuscript of his book of reminiscences, had exceeded the limits of what a man should ask a butler to do. The responsibility, he considered, was one which no butler, however desirous of giving satisfaction, should have been called upon to undertake. The thought of all that hung upon his vigilance unnerved him, and he had been brooding on it with growing uneasiness for perhaps 5 minutes, when the sound of feet shuffling on wood told him that he had no longer got his favourite oasis to himself. An individual or individuals had come into the summer house. "We can talk here," said a voice, and a seat creaked as if a heavy body had lowered himself upon it. And such was indeed the case. It was Lord Tilbury, who had just sat down, and his was one of the heaviest bodies in Fleet Street. When a few minutes before, meditating in the lounge of the Emsworth Arms, he'd beheld Monty Bodkin enter through the front door, Lord Tilbury's first thought had been for some quiet retreat where they could confer in solitude. He could see that the young man had much to say, and he had no desire to have him say it with half a dozen inquisitive Shropshire lads within easy earshot. Great minds think alike. Beach, intent on an unobtrusive glass of beer, and Lord Tilbury, loath to have intimate private matters discussed in an hotel lounge, had both come to the conclusion that true solitude was best to be obtained at the bottom of the garden. Silencing his young friend accordingly with an imperious gesture, his lordship had led the way to this remote summer house.
"Well," he said, having seated himself, "what is it?"
It seemed to Beach, who had settled himself comfortably in his chair and was preparing to listen to the conversation with something of the air of a nonchalant dramatic critic watching the curtain go up, that the voice was vaguely familiar. He had a feeling that he had heard it before, but could not remember where or when. He had no difficulty, however, in recognizing the one which now spoke in answer. Monty Bodkin's vocal delivery, when his soul was at all deeply disturbed, was individual and peculiar, containing something of the tonal quality of a bleating sheep, combined with a suggestion of a barking prairie wolf.
"What is it? I like that."
Monty's soul at this moment was very deeply disturbed. Since breakfast that morning, this young man, like Sir Gregory Parslow, had run what is known as the gamut of the emotions. A pictorial record of his hopes and despairs would have looked like a fever chart. He had begun, over the coffee and kippers, by feeling gay and buoyant. It seemed to him that fortune, good old fortune, had amazingly decently put him on to a red-hot thing. All he had to do, in order to ensure the year's employment which would enable him to win Gertrude Butterwick, was to nip into the small library and lift the manuscript out of the desk in which Lord Tilbury had assured him it reposed. Feeling absolutely in the pink, accordingly, and nipping as planned, he had fallen, like Lucifer, from heaven to hell. The bally thing was not there. Fortune, in a word, had been pulling his leg. And here was this old ass before him saying, "What is it?"
"Yes, I like that," he repeated. "That's rich. Oh, very fruity indeed."
Lord Tilbury, as we've said, had never been very fond of Monty. In his present peculiar mood, he found himself liking him less than ever.
"What is it you wish to see me about?"
he asked, with testy curtness.
"What do you think I want to see you about?" replied Monty shrilly. "About that dashed manuscript of Galley's that you told me to pinch, of course," he said with a bitter laugh,
and Beach, having given a single shuddering start like a harpooned whale, sat rigid in his chair, his gooseberry eyes bulging, the beer frozen, as one might say, on his lips. Nor was Lord Tilbury unmoved. No plotter likes to have his accomplices bellowing important secrets as if they were calling coals.
"Shh! But nobody can hear us."
"Nevertheless, kindly do not shout. Where is the manuscript? Haven't you got it?"
"Of course I've not got it."
Lord Tilbury was feeling dismally that he might have expected this. He saw now how foolish he'd been to place so delicate a commission in the hands of a popinjay. Of all classes of the community, popinjays, when it comes to carrying out delicate commissions, are the most inept. Search history's pages from end to end, reflected Lord Tilbury, and you will not find one instance of a popinjay doing anything successfully except eat, sleep, and master the new dance steps.
"It's a bit thick," bellowed Monty.
"Shh!
It's a bit thick," repeated Monty, sinking his voice to a conspiratorial growl. "Raising hopes only to cast them to the ground is the way I look at it. What did you want to get me all worked up for by telling me the thing was in that desk?"
"It is not," said Lord Tilbury, staggered.
"Not a trace of it."
"You cannot have looked properly."
"Looked properly? Shh! Of course I looked properly. I've left no stone unturned. I explored every avenue."
"But I saw Threepwood put it there."
"Says you."
"Don't say says you. I tell you I saw him with my own eyes place the manuscript in the top right-hand drawer of the desk."
"Well, he must have moved it. It's not there now."
"Then it's somewhere else."
"I shouldn't wonder. But where?"
"You could easily have found out."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Don't say, oh, yeah."
"Well, what can I say, dash it? First you keep yowling shush every time I open my mouth, then you tell me not to say says you, and now you beef at me, remarking, oh, yeah. I suppose what you'd really like," said Monty, and it was plain to the listening ear that he was deeply moved, "would be for me to buy a flannel dressing gown and a spade and become a ruddy Trappist monk."
This spirited outburst led to a certain amount of rather confused debate. Lord Tilbury said that he did not propose to have young popinjays taking that tone with him, while Monty, on his side, wished to be informed who Lord Tilbury was calling a popinjay. Lord Tilbury then said that Monty was a bungler, and Monty said, well, dash it, Lord Tilbury had told him to be a burglar, and Lord Tilbury said he had not said burglar, he'd said bungler.
And Monty said, what did he mean, bungler? And Lord Tilbury explained that by the expression bungler he'd intended to signify a wretched, feckless, blundering, incompetent imbecile. He added that an infant of 6 could have found the manuscript, and Monty, in a striking passage, was making a firm offer to give any bloodhound in England a shilling if it could do better than he had done, when the argument stopped as abruptly as it had started. Childish voices had begun to prattle close at hand, and it was evident that one of those picnic parties from the river was approaching. "Caw," said Lord Tilbury, rather in the manner of the moping owl in Gray's Elegy under similar provocation. One of the childish voices spoke.
"Pa, there's someone here."
Another followed.
"Ma, there's someone here."
The deeper voice of a male adult made itself heard. "Emily, there's someone here." And then the voice of a female adult.
"Oh, dear, what a shame. There's someone here."
The conspirators appeared to be men who could take a tactful hint when they heard one. There came to Beach's ears the sound of moving bodies. And presently, from the fact that the summer house seemed to have become occupied by a troop of performing elephants, he gathered that the occupation had been carried through according to plan. He sat on for some minutes, then, hurrying to the inn, asked leave of the landlord to use his telephone in order to summon Robinson and his station taxi. His mind was made up. He would not know an easy moment until he was back in his pantry, on guard. The station taxi would run into money, for Robinson, like all monopolists, drove a hard bargain, but if it could get him to the castle before Monty, it would be half a crown well spent. "Robinson's taxi's outside now, Mr. Beach," said the landlord, tickled by the coincidence. "A gentleman phoned for it only 2 minutes ago. Going up to the castle himself, he is. Maybe he'd give you a lift. You can catch him if you run." End of side 8.